You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Transfer Window, the podcast that brings you the news before it becomes news, as well as insight and analysis to all the subjects you're talking about in football. I'm Ian McGarry, and with me as always is the guru, Duncan Castles. Today we're going to be bringing you extensive news on Manchester United, on Manchester City, Aston Villa, on Barcelona, and on Tottenham Hotspur, as well as some news on Burnley, who have made a real effort in order to keep their side together. First, Duncan, we're going to start at Old Trafford, where it looks like the new football division have been very busy. The protocol and strategy they have in place, mainly for a striker for the next season, as well as players who are exiting, appears to be taking shape. What can you tell us with regards to the detail of that particular plan that they have put in place?
Definitely very busy, this new setup with Solskjaer at its head in terms of determining which positions need to be recruited in, and then the massive scouting team that Ed Woodward is so proud of talking about, providing potential names. John Murto now in an influential role in that transfer committee with his new formal position. And Darren Fletcher brought in to assist and collaborate with them and work directly with agents on getting these deals done. The final determining factor, as always, is the Glazers. Interestingly, I'm being briefed that the football committee, if you want to call it that, does not yet have a clear idea on budget. It will depend on what the Glazers approve. And as we've been discussing in this podcast for weeks now, that probably comes down to PR perspective of what is seen to have to be spent to appease fans who are literally revolting against the Glazer ownership. However, within that context, there is a clear priority for Solskjaer and his recruitment specialists, and that is that they sign a forward. Now, they have an interesting setup in that they're looking both for a centre forward and for a right-sided forward, but they will probably only sign one of those. Why? Because they feel that bringing a top talent in that position, and they're looking at high price, high quality acquisition, can be accommodated within the current squad. If they go for a right-sided player, Jadon Sancho is the most obvious target there, the player that they wanted to sign last summer, that they had an agreement on terms with the player, felt they could convince Borussia Dortmund to bring down their 120 million asking price, failed to do so in the end. Should they bring Sancho or another top quality right winger in, Mason Greenwood would move into a central forward role alongside sharing the position essentially with Edinson Cavani, and Anthony Martial would be moved out, as we told you on earlier podcasts. If instead they go for a top quality centre forward, and Cristiano Ronaldo is on the list of potential acquisitions, as is Erling Haaland, who would be Solskjaer's preference, then Mason Greenwood would stay on the right-hand side where he's been playing for the last season and more, and share that position with the emerging Amad Diallo and Dan James. So I think that it's quite unusual, but I see the logic to it. You bring in one of the two and you shift Greenwood basically from one position on the right to the central position if necessary, which is the position that Solskjaer sees him at the end or further into his career as adopting and becoming the starting centre forward for United. Ronaldo, as we've said, is of interest to them. He has been offered to them. As we've said, Juventus want to move Cristiano Ronaldo out this summer. That is something that Max Allegri is in favour of doing. They won't say publicly that that's their stance, but it's open secret in football. Ronaldo's been offered to Madrid, who have publicly said no, to Manchester United and to Paris Saint-Germain. Ronaldo's camp think the more likely outcome at present is Paris Saint-Germain. However, there is a strong interest from Manchester United and he could be a resolution to this. I think there's another factor here that we should add, which is that Paul Pogba has 1 year left in contract. United are worried that he's going to run that contract down to zero. They're going to lose him without transfer fee. Remember, he remains the record signing, remains the most expensive player and the incoming player in the history of English football. They don't want that to happen. It has been hard for Pogba to find another club able to pay a transfer fee and prepared to pay his salary and to take on a player who's, because of his behaviour and his time at Manchester United, is seen as a problem individual. However, I can tell you that Max Allegri is a fan of Pogba, had a very good relationship with Pogba when they worked together at Juventus, and I'm told would be interested in bringing him back to Juventus if that fitted in with the rest of his transfer plans and it could be done in a way that could be accommodated with the limited budget they have. There you have a potential solution in that Ronaldo could be moved to Manchester United should Manchester United decide that is the forward player who is the best option for them. A fee could be attached to the deal. Pogba go the other way to Juventus. Again, a fee be attached to the deal. You have essentially a financial fair play swap, similar to what Juventus did with Barcelona last summer in taking Artur Melo from Barcelona for a substantial initial fee of and have Pjanic, in that case, move back to Barcelona for an initial 60 million euros. And what that allowed Juventus, allowed both clubs to do because of the way transfer fees are amortised, is to book a positive economic effect, as they called it, for that year's transactions. In Juventus's case, they were able to declare an economic benefit of 41.8 million euros from the swap deal. So there's attractions there to both clubs in terms of a way you can manufacture a deal, but that would depend on United deciding that Ronaldo is the priority. In their discussions with Ronaldo's representative to date, the representative don't feel that he is being prioritised. They've been told that United are interested, but to wait and see what happens. Then, once United have solved that forward position, once they know what degree of financial cost is involved in that, they will look at other positions. They are looking at centre midfield, they're looking at centre back, they're looking at a backup right back. Already doing work on those, they're identifying targets, but they don't know how many they'll be able to do and how much they'll be able to allocate to those positions until they're sure what happens with the forward.
This is a project made a lot more difficult, Duncan, by the Euros. As we've known from experience, getting a player to complete a medical while on international duty is complex, to say the least, because the manager of the national team do not want a player leaving the camp. So in order to furnish just quite so many players in one window when there's a month-long tournament ahead does seem to be very, very ambitious.
Yeah, it's more complex, and I think it's made more difficult because the people involved don't actually know what the budget is. They're dependent on, and this has been the Glazers' way throughout their time, when they've been running the club, which is each individual deal has to be presented to them, the finances of it presented to them, and they sign off one by one. So that complicates it. And if they had a set budget, then they'd be able to organise this, I think, a bit more strategically. Interesting what Solskjaer has been saying about recruitment. He gave an interview in Norway last week, where he said, "We want the best players here and the club knows what I want. I do not know how the dialogue goes, but if we are to fight for the best trophies, we must have the best players." Which is it's an interesting comment from it. It's been perceived by some Manchester United supporters as him putting pressure on the board. You could also run that argument the other way and say, if they're going to compete for the best trophies, given that they have one of the best squads around at present already, maybe the more efficient way would be to change the manager and get better value out of the players they've already got, instead of being stuck with a manager who 2.5 years in has yet to win a trophy, as has Manchester United on their longest trophy drought for over 3 decades. And generally, I think has failed to add value in terms of results on the field and in terms of actually bringing silverware in.
So two factors are going to be very important in this particular strategy. One will be how much the Glazers are willing to furnish for transfers. The other will be, of course, who they can sell and how much money they can get for them. Two other players, Duncan, who will be involved in the Euros and who are also involved in effectively a swap deal, are Bernardo Silva of Portugal and Saúl Ñíguez of Spain. Atletico and Manchester City seem to be on the same wavelength regards to what they both want and need out of those players, but as yet no agreement as far as we know.
Yeah, and this is an offer, it's a proposal from Atletico that Manchester City take Saúl Ñíguez, their 26-year-old midfielder, one of their club captains. And Bernardo Silva comes from Manchester City to Atletico in exchange. I don't think this deal is going to happen. I don't think that City are going to prioritise it over other areas that they're looking for. However, I can see the possibility of Bernardo going to Atletico. Bernardo wants to leave Manchester City. He, I'm told, had a promise that he could leave last year. After a difficult season, you'll remember one of the things that happened to him was he was handed down a Football Association ban after a social media post, something that he took very badly. Was not impressed with that. There's also a factor that he is keen to leave Manchester. He doesn't enjoy Manchester life, and would like to move to a different climate. But there's an expectation on his side that he will be allowed to leave this summer. I think there's a potential for an alternative FFP swap deal, if you like, because this is a similar proposal to the Artur Pjanic one. Atletico do need to sort out their FFP situation. So you would put a high value on Saul or another player and put a high value on Bernardo and take that amortization benefit to both sides on your books. Remember, City are very interested in Jean Felix. They wanted to sign that player before he went to Atletico. In fact, they told him, "We want to bring you here. We can't do it in this summer." That was 2019. "Please wait a year. We'll take you then." Felix wanted his move from Benfica immediately, decided to go to Atletico. It hasn't worked for him. As we told you in earlier podcasts, he's unhappy there. Doesn't like the relationship with Diego Simeone, doesn't like the way he has trained him, made him play through injuries, where he's been selected, has very good figures for them in terms of goals and assists per appearances, and expects to leave this summer. So I think there's a scenario where Felix could be offered to Manchester City and Bernardo go the other way. He is not the priority for City at present. They want a replacement for Bernardo and want a centre forward. But as things pan through, that there's a possibility they'll go back for a player who they badly wanted in 2019 and still like. I'm told that what City are focusing on as a replacement for Bernardo and in their transfer business at present is attacking midfielder and that Jack Grealish is extremely high on their list. And they think there is a real possibility of getting him from Aston Villa and pairing him with Phil Foden in their midfield and building a, you know, an English national team duo that could play together, you know, potentially for 10 years. And they feel that Aston Villa, and I think correctly, they feel Aston Villa are making preparations to cash in on Grealish. Aston Villa actually have, I'm told, a substantial budget to work with. They're one of the better placed teams in the Premier League post-COVID. This week, they've signed Wendia from Norwich City for an initial $33 million. That is kind of a half replacement for Grealish, as it's been described to me. And they're looking at other attacking midfielders coming as well. One of the players they've sounded out is Emile Smith-Rowe at Arsenal, who broke into the Arsenal team to great effect this season. He is under contract till 2023. So something needs to be done by Arsenal in terms of extending that deal or seeing him being tempted by other clubs. I think it would be quite damaging for Arsenal if they were seen to lose a young talent like that to a club like Aston Villa. But I think it's telling in terms of the ambitions Villa have for this coming season. They're also looking for a striker, someone who can share or operate as a backup alternative to Ollie Watkins, a winger, a centre-back and a backup goalkeeper.
Well, the precedent was set with Emi Martinez leaving Arsenal for Aston Villa. So there's not exactly an unusual trip to make from North London over to the Midlands. So a little bit, I wouldn't say square pegs in round holes in some of those deals you mentioned, Duncan. Maybe triangles in round holes, as Saul Niguez is not a direct replacement for Bernardo Silva. As you said, Emil Buendia is not a direct replacement for Jack Grealish. I think it's going to be quite ironic if Grealish ends up at the Etihad because, as we know, Manchester City are the experts in tactical fouling and Grealish is the expert in winning tactical fouls. So they'll have both sides of the coin should Grealish join them this summer. Maybe some good news for Arsenal is their pursuit of Wolverhampton Wanderers' Ruben Neves, a player who's made a real impact since arriving at Molineux, Duncan. What is the state of play with Neves and leaving, as well as what would you expect the price to be?
The price is the big question, and that will be up to Fosun to decide. As we told you some months ago, the Wolves need to raise money in this transfer market. They have Bruno Lage coming in, a story we broke, I think, in April, that he'd been identified as a replacement for, you know, Espirito Santo, who's still deciding on which club he will go to, having lots of discussions with a couple of other Premier League clubs, Crystal Palace and Everton at present. Neves has been placed on the market, Adama Traore on the market, Pedro Neto on the market, although the serious injury he suffered is a detriment to doing that sale this summer. Arsenal have begun working on that deal. They would see Neves as a replacement for Granit Xhaka, who's trying to get to Roma at the moment to be part of Jose Mourinho's midfield there. I think the question is, what have Fosun balked at before? Well, in 2019, they were offered $60 million for Neves and said no. They wanted $80 million at that point. The contract has obviously reduced by 2 years since then. We'll say they've got 3 years of additional contract on the deal. Discussion of it would possibly be €50 million as an asking price this summer, but the price hasn't been established yet. And I think there is definitely the prospect of competition from other clubs for Neves. Now they know he's available. Now Arsenal have put a move in play. If a price can be established, I think you probably see other clubs trying to get him as well.
Now, a lot of speculation, Duncan, over the position of Sean Dyche at Burnley. Dyche was heavily linked with replacing Roy Hodgson at Crystal Palace. It's something which never really materialised despite the momentum that it had. And Dyche himself inferred at certain points last season that perhaps he'd taken Burnley as far as he could. Maybe it was time for a new challenge. However, the board at Burnley have come up with what they hope is a solution to keep their manager.
Yeah, Dyche has been there since 2012, which is quite a run for any coach, taking them obviously into the Premier League and kept them there. Yeah, right, he's been mentioned as a strong candidate for Crystal Palace. Kind of almost the same type of manager in Roy Hodgson in terms of the way he sets teams up and the way he has them playing, which is, given that Crystal Palace's plan has been to get younger players into the team, change and play a more adventurous type of football, try and change the balance of their squad, which they will be able to do because a number of their senior players are now out of contract, so the new manager coming in can make quite substantial changes there. Dyche doesn't seem the obvious fit if you want to make those radical changes. Burnley have been worried about losing him. He has 1 year left on his current contract. I'm told they've made him an offer of a long-term deal with a pay rise to around £6 million a year. Substantial extension in terms of security. He would retain the powers he has over the transfer market, which are just about as strong as anyone in the Premier League at present. It basically had authority over the direction of the club delegated to him in a way that few managers have these days. But Burnley are unsure. They're concerned that he will decide to go elsewhere. There was an indication from a well-placed journalist at the weekend that Dyche had decided to stay at Burnley. I think, given what's been happening with Nuno Espirito Santo and Crystal Palace over the last 24 hours, we will probably see an opportunity for Crystal Palace to decide whether Dyche is the guy they want to go for and whether they're going to make an offer for him and make him make a call over that new contract he's been offered at Burnley or not.
My information in terms of Dyche, Duncan, is that he'll need more than a substantial pay rise and a contract extension to be persuaded to stay. Most of the aggravation and friction he's had with the board has been over player recruitment. He feels like he has not been given assets which reflect adequately the achievements of the last 2-3 seasons. And also, of course, Burnley staying in the Premier League as well. Dyche is ambitious. He wants to take Burnley further up the table. It wouldn't surprise me if he sees himself as a future England manager, not in the image of Roy Hodgson, but perhaps more in the image of supersized Sam. However, that is a long way away as yet. But we, of course, will bring you the news first here on the Transfer Window podcast of any incomings at Burnley. Lots of fanfare, Duncan, about the appointment of Fabio Patrici as sport director at Tottenham Hotspur. This is certainly a departure for Daniel Levy, who, as we know, likes to control everything at the football club, even if some people in the club say that's not true. He also is someone who likes to make decisions on transfers, and Paratici's job, you would have thought, as sport director, would be to both identify players to come into the club as well as ascertain the information required on fee and contract cost, etc. Yes, of course, Levy will have the final sign-off, but Paratici, used to working in Italy, does usually have that power, both at Juventus and Inter. It would be a difficult, potentially explosive relationship should it not quite go the way that it's been sold to Paratici.
Look, I'm, as are a number of people I speak to in European football, stunned that Daniel Levy is doing this. It hasn't been formally announced yet, but the word is that the job is Paratici's, new sports director coming in, and Tottenham are happy for it to be reported that all football matters will be delegated to Paratici. with Daniel Levy just working on the final financials. Paratici was effectively sacked by Juventus. He was one of the conditions that Max Allegri placed upon John Elkann to persuade him to come back to Juventus as coach and sort out the problems, which saw them drop to fourth in Serie A and only just get fourth place in Serie A this season. It was one of the conditions that Allegri needed to step away from the agreement he had to become Real Madrid coach, because he had had such a difficult time working with Paratici and didn't want to work with him again, blamed him for his removal as coach a couple of years ago. That was Paratici's plan to change the coaching staff, which he sold to Andrea Agnelli, with Maurizio Sarri coming in unsuccessfully, and then another change to Andrea Pirlo and another unsuccessful move. Juventus finances are a mess. They have Cristiano Ronaldo in the team, but are trying to shift them out. They've got a number of other older players that they've signed on massive contracts, quite often under freedom of contract. For example, Aaron Ramsey. The balance hasn't worked in the squad. The squad's got poorer. And Paratici had a big part in all of that. Yet, Levy is taking him to be a sports director when over a year ago, when Jose Mourinho proposed Luis Campos as sports director, Levy didn't want to get involved in that discussion. It's going to be fascinating to see how it pans out. The first job, obviously, is to get a manager. They're having big problems with that. I hear that there is an additional candidate they're working on in the shape of Julian Lopetegui, who could be a solution for them if they can't get one of their earlier choices, that Lopetegui is liked by Tottenham and likely to be recommended to them by Paratici. Certainly has a good track record of work at Sevilla, winning the Europa League in 2020 and finishing third and fourth, getting them into the Champions League 2 years running, but extended his contract in January until 2024. The other, and I think the priority for Tottenham, if they can make it happen, remains Maurizio Pochettino. As we told you on the podcast last week, Leonardo's position at PSG as sports director is in doubt. Qatar are making a decision over that at the moment. They're looking at alternative candidates. In fact, Paratici was one of the potential replacements for Leonardo. Leonardo's relationship with Pochettino is bad. And there is a feeling that if Qatar decide to retain Leonardo, Pochettino will make another move to get out of the club. He tried to do that first by getting the Real Madrid job when Allegri fell through. Secondly, by encouraging talks with Tottenham. So I'm hearing that there's a bit of a waiting game there, in that Tottenham are hoping Pochettino might open up and then looking at alternative candidates such as Lopetegui if that doesn't happen.
I'm guessing Paratici will soon find out exactly what kind of mandate he has, Duncan, if he goes to Daniel Levy and says, okay, this squad needs strengthening in this, and this position. You're not going to give me the money to get the players that we need in order to compete at that level. Therefore, we're going to sell Harry Kane.
Yeah, look, that is the big option open to Tottenham, and Kane wants to leave. Kane's made it quite clear he wants to leave. He is on that list of forwards for Manchester United. His preference, his personal preference, seems to be to move to Manchester City. Chelsea have an interest, but don't think Levy would sell to them. But it is an option for Tottenham and Paratici and Daniel Levy to say, okay, we grant you your wish, Harry Kane, but we expect well over £100 million as the transfer fee. And then you have a lot of resource to invest in changing the team, which is what you'd expect a new sporting director to want to have. I don't know what Paratici's position is on Kane. I haven't asked that. But it would be typical for a new sports director coming into a club where he knows there are financial issues to want to generate revenue in order to place his mark on the team.
one Premier League champion who is leaving, not for over £100 million, but indeed for free, is Liverpool's Dutch midfielder, Gini Wijnaldum. He had agreed, Duncan, we understand, to join Barcelona, something which you reported a long time ago, but has since changed his mind and will instead sign for Paris Saint-Germain. And this has become quite an interesting situation because your information is that Wijnaldum will actually have to pay Barcelona in order to get to Paris.
Yes, it's a fascinating transaction, this one, in that Wijnaldum to Barcelona was agreed a couple of months ago and a pre-contract deal, which, as we told you on the podcast, had an expiry date, and Barcelona failed to activate turn the pre-contract into a full contract before the date expired. Bayern Munich came in and made an offer to Wijnaldum. Wijnaldum took that back to Barcelona, ultimately decided he would commit to Barcelona. Another pre-contract agreement was drawn up. Barcelona thought they had their man. He was actually due to take his medical this Monday and to be announced this week. And then Paris Saint-Germain came in with a hugely improved offer over the terms Wijnaldum had accepted with Barcelona. Wijnaldum went back to Barcelona and said he, according to Barcelona, that he wanted to be paid the same amount to go to them rather than PSG. Barcelona said, no way, we can't do this. The brief from Barcelona is that the wages Wijnaldum was expecting were double the amount, the already substantial amount he'd agreed to move there. However, there is a, because he has broken his pre-contract agreement, Barcelona, what I expect to be compensated for that breach of that contract. Now, in principle, Wijnaldum will have to pay that. But I think in practice, the money will come from Paris Saint-Germain because that is the way these things are organised.
Indeed, I was going to make that point. The money will certainly not be coming out of Gini's wallet, that's for sure. So from Gini Wijnaldum and his roundabout story, we have Nuno Espirito Santo and the mystery of the Palace of Smoke and Mirrors. Former Wolves boss was supposed to be signing, according to most media outlets, this week, and suddenly the whole thing was called off. We know that Everton were also interested in them and may still be. Duncan, you have got a lot more detail on this, and it is an intriguing tale of claim and counterclaim.
Again, last week's podcast, we discussed that Everton had spoken to Nuno and that he had also talked to Crystal Palace. Previous to that, he'd been impressed by Steve Parrish and liked what he heard from Crystal Palace. But Everton, the more attractive job was the guidance I'd had, but no definite decision taken. On Monday, there were further talks between Nuno Espirito Santo and Everton. In fact, I understand that Farhad Moshiri was in London on Monday to conduct those talks and was confident that they could come to an agreement. The guidance I had from Nuno's camp was that no agreement would happen that day. The following day, there were talks between Crystal Palace and Nuno Espirito Santo, and those progressed to the extent where Palace thought they had their man, thought they had an agreement, and it even gone to the point of drawing up contracts which they expected to be signed yesterday evening. My understanding is that Everton continued to push Nuno, particularly after they heard that he was close to joining Crystal Palace, and that Nuno was unable to decide between the two clubs, which was the best of the offers currently on the table to him. Since then, Crystal Palace have briefed that they are out, that they have finished their discussions with Nuno because he had increased his demands overnight and they would be looking at other candidates. Everton, I'm told, have been in contact separately with Christophe Galtier's agent, so they have been looking at some alternatives options. They've had a lot of names placed to them. The guidance I have on their strategy is that they feel they need to have a ready-made manager, an experienced manager, ideally one who knows the Premier League, can fit straight into their camp, not make too many radical changes in terms of coaching philosophy, not be experimental in the way they're working, just take a methodology that they've used successfully at another club, apply it to Everton, and progress them in the way they've been expecting to do with Carlo Ancelotti, but ultimately wasn't reflected in their the final league position. So they're wary about taking a risk in this appointment, which would explain why they're pushing so hard for Nuno, because you're looking there at someone who has 3-year track record in the Premier League, very high achievement in terms of results with Wolves in his first two seasons, beyond expectation achievements in his first two seasons, and a difficult third season, but one that's easily explicable in terms of injuries to key striker Raul Jimenez, and the problems of navigating the COVID season. So final decision to be made. If Crystal Palace's brief is accurate, Nuno no longer has the option of going there, and his option in the Premier League at present is Everton. Unless another club comes in, you would expect him to end up as Everton manager.
Isn't it remarkable, Duncan, that when David Moyes is at an advanced stage of new contract negotiations with West Ham, that his name should be mentioned of going back to Everton?
I think that's that. To be fair, that's a genuine one. As we've discussed in the podcast, when we talked about the Everton situation, that you've got a board split there. You have Bill Kenwright, who would like David Moyes to come back, or Roberto Martinez. Basically, every time Everton have a managerial vacancy, Kenwright proposes David Moyes or Roberto Martinez, who are two of his own previous picks. You have Farhad Moshiri, who is the titular owner of the club, but Alisher Usmanov is actually the man in control of the shares of the club. He has a degree of authority. You have Kia Jarabshin, who's close to both of those individuals, recommending managers. Then you have Marcel Brands as the sports director, who would like his say on who the manager would be. It's a complicated scenario they have there. And I think it explains a lot of the problems that Everton have suffered over the last few years, and why this appointment becomes so important for them to get right.
Gloriously, the transfer window is open, but we're going to have to bring this particular pod to a close. We'll do so with hero and villain. And Duncan, your hero, please, for this week.
Yeah, a hero based on some sad news that Yu Sung Cho, who was a central midfielder, was a key part of the 2002 South Korea national team that made the semi-final of the World Cup against pretty much everyone's expectations, died of cancer this week. That had particular resonance to me, as that was the first World Cup I covered, and I was charged with covering the South Korean side of the World Cup, spent a lot of time with the South Korean national team. He loved watching their football with Goh Sidink as the coach. Yu was one of the key elements in a midfield, of extremely hard-working midfield. Obviously, I think the most famous of the players to come out of it, Park Ji-sung, was a young player who was based in Japan at the time, where I was working for a newspaper. Just a really exciting side to watch, and in an amazing atmosphere where you'd get these stadia that were wall-to-wall red home Korean supporters chanting in a way I've never heard before. Just such an impressive performance and an impressive event. And you, interestingly, I didn't know this at the time, but you was playing in Japanese football, had been at Yokohama Marinos and moved to Kashiwa Reysol. At the point when he was sold from Korean football to Japanese football, Barcelona wanted to take him on trial, and his club in Korea blocked that because they already had a financial agreement with Marinos. So maybe could have been a player who didn't simply do it on the world stage at the World Cup, and he scored in that World Cup. He could have been a player who did it in European football as well, if it hadn't been for the control that the Korean club had and saying, you know, you go to Japanese football, we don't give you a chance in Europe.
And of course, our thoughts and sympathies are with you's friends and family at this time. Going on to the villain, well, it's a fairly obvious one this week, and that is, for well, I guess two sets of villains. One, the England fans who booed when their own players took the knee ahead of the two friendlies that have been played in prior to Euro 2020 starting. Really, how you can possibly justify booing your own team before they even start a game is beyond me, especially when their stance is specifically about racial equality and social justice. But maybe even worse, our politicians have waded into this debate. And then there was a top Tory who likened taking the knee to doing a Nazi salute. Of course, the Nazis were well known for fighting for racial equality and social injustice. So that's my villain of the week. And you've been listening to the podcast that brings you the news before it becomes news. You can reach us on all our social media channels and give us a nice 5-star review in iTunes. Get Duncan on at Duncan Castles, me on at Carbos J. We'll be back with you later in the week. Stay safe, be well, and thanks for listening.